Hello and welcome to the Multiplanetary Society podcast, where we explore topics related to the space economy and the how and why of potentially becoming a multiplanetary species. I'm your host, Timothy Reuter. Today, we are pleased to have with us Dr. Harold Sonny White, Director of Advanced R&D for the Limitless Space Institute. Dr. White, welcome to the show.
Hey, Timothy. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to our discussion today.
The Limitless Space Institute's vision statement is advance human exploration beyond our solar system. Why is exploring beyond our solar system an important goal?
Right. You know, I think sometimes I like to take it down to a little bit more practical note, and maybe even let's pull your question even a little bit further back, right? And just talk about why space. Let's just maybe address that first. You know, the whole premise of space exploration, or just utilizing space in general, it brings a lot of benefits to us as a species and as a culture and a society. I mean, consider the following, right? You know, in North America, right, 70% of all agriculture is guided by GPS-equipped cultivation equipment. So, you know, almost everything we buy that's like a muffin or bread, right, 70% of that has a dependency on space. And, you know, just consider real briefly the following notional day for somebody, right? Why would anyone really care about space exploration? Right? So if somebody wakes up in the morning and they go get their cup of coffee and a muffin, right, they pay for that cup of coffee using the internet and digital commerce. And so all of that is connected to this global network of banks and computers. And that's all, you know, that has a dependency on space. And maybe the muffin that they buy, you know, a portion of that muffin is definitely cultivated using space-borne assets. And maybe this individual checks the weather in the morning because they want to understand, you know, what's the rest of the day look like, and the weather predictions, all that stuff is enabled because of global satellite observation coupled with ground radar stations. And so space is heavily integrated into that. And you know, maybe this individual is going to go, a friend's flying into town and they're checking the status of the flight and where the plane's at. And that's all connected to space-borne assets providing that communication, right? And so, I mean, just we can all kind of identify with bits and pieces of this story and maybe automatically extend a little further some things we might think of. And so space is heavily involved in all of those bits and pieces. And so sometimes I think it's good to remind ourselves, right, that space, even, you know, even today in the here and now, it is an integral piece of our daily experience, right? And a lot of things we do are completely dependent upon it, right? And so extending from that, kind of switching into maybe more the philosophical point of view, right? Pursuing a better tomorrow in space will always provide a better today here on Earth, right? In the process of trying to enable some of these bold hopes and aspirations, right? We're going to come up with technologies and systems and so forth that can always provide benefit for us here on Earth. And then I'll even extend further, right? Think about if we one day have a solar system-wide culture and community, right? We would then have access to an entire solar system worth of resources and such. And the whole concept of scarcity, right, kind of changes at that point. And so in my mind, that's another beautiful example of expanding our experience into the solar system changes the concept of scarcity. And then I'll finish with this, right? In order for us to be able to move about freely in the solar system, and maybe even one day onto other star systems, right? I mean, maybe that's the furthest extent, right, that we will one day become not only just a multiplanetary species, but a multi-stellar species. The power and propulsion systems that are necessary to enable that type of a capability, right? I mean, that changes everything. If you think about quality of life and you equate that to people's access to abundant amount of power, right? There is a correlation, right? And so being able to move very quickly between destinations that are really far apart, It by definition, you need to have extremely high power, lightweight, robust systems. And so again, that's a way for me to kind of defend that statement. Pursuing a better tomorrow in space provides for a better today here on Earth, right? So anyway, I'll pause and hand the microphone back to you.
No, I like that framing. And of course, as you can imagine, a podcast entitled Multiplanetary Society, we're pretty sympathetic to that view. But I think, you know, we always need to be working hard on how we articulate this. I think sort of the low Earth orbit economy is pretty well established as something that benefits society broadly. And you made, you know, the arguments around, you know, GPS, which helps with everything from agriculture to dating nowadays, right? I mean, it's used our lives and even some of the more comical areas. You know, once you get to solar system wide, you are getting a bit more philosophical and speculative, but I think people can wrap their minds around the idea that there are resources out there that if we can access, you know, that would be beneficial. And once we get to talking about interstellar, which is just beyond what most people have spent time thinking about, I think we need to be even more thoughtful about how we articulate it. So this is something I try and get all of our guests to talk about is, you know, why is this a worthwhile pursuit and a worthwhile investment of resources? Because it's really going to take, I think, a society-wide movement in order to get the kind of investments needed to get to those next frontiers. But sort of moving on to the next theme, we've articulated what is LSI's vision and why is that vision worth pursuing. So how is LSI going about accomplishing advancing exploration beyond our solar system?
Right. So actually, is it okay if we just kind of stay back on that topic for just a second? I want to kind of
absolutely
a couple of things, if that's okay. And then we'll switch into, you know, LSI, our mission and how we're putting rubber to the road. Right. Because, you know, in my mind, there's kind of two points I want to make. Right. And I suppose one is philosophical and the other one's a little bit more practical. Mm-hmm. And the philosophical side. Right. Others have talked about this exploration thing that we feel, some of us feel. Right. Mm-hmm. I think the informal parlance is the exploration gene in any gathering of folks around the campfire. There are one or two that kind of have this, they're a little restless and something's just kind of in them, right? So, you know, going all the way back to our ancestors sitting around the campfire, sharing an evening together, there's whether it's 10 or 20 individuals there, there's at least one, right? That's kind of while halfway listening to what's going on around the campfire, they're kind of looking off to the distance, right? And they're thinking, I wonder what's beyond that hill. I want to go look, right? And so in the process of following this thing that's in them that kind of bids them to go kind of look beyond what everyone knows, maybe they find, hey, there's this beautiful body of water and there's some tasty fish that are there and there's some bushes that grow by the side of the body of water. It's got some nice fruit that's pretty tasty. And so, you know, by going out and following this initiative and exercising it, they find, you know, these promising things. And then they come back and they tell the rest of their troop, right? Hey, look, I found some cool stuff over here, right? So it's almost like the premise of exploration, the exploration gene, is an evolutionary characteristic that's baked into us. And in point in fact, is most likely what has made us very successful as a species, because we always have a small subset, right, that do want to kind of go, they want to take the path less taken, right, or the path less traveled, right? And so I think this is a philosophical discussion. I concede that. But I think it's grounded in experience that there is a value proposition for us not forgetting that this is an important thing. And so you can't always come up with the deterministic A, B, C, D, you know, flow chart of if this, then this, if this, then this, and so forth, all of a sudden, good things, right? So philosophical point. Now, from more of a practical standpoint, in terms of space exploration, so I'm kind of switching back into my working with NASA headquarters folks and thinking about things in general. So I think we may see in the next 10 years, we may see the development of terrestrial fusion power, right? Where we have fusion reactors that are burning deuterium and tritium, right? And generating net power that goes onto the grid. And by extension, maybe connected or inspired by that, there may be some adaptations of the idea of fusion for use in space, whether it's just as a propulsion system that still plugs into a source of power, or it's a propulsion system that also generates power. There are things they can do. But all of a sudden, if that's true, all of a sudden, we now have a capability, right? And so from a practical perspective, we as a species, when we develop a capability like an automobile or a plane or whatever, we use it to the fullest extent that we can use it, right? Whatever way that we can imagine it might be used, we usually just use it, right? And you don't have to have a debate of will we or won't we. As soon as it's there and available, we make use of it, right? And so in some ways, some of the whole premise of space exploration, in my mind, when we develop the capabilities, if they come about because of other reasons that are just naturally going on, we actually probably won't even have to have the philosophical debate because it's going to get used no matter what, right? You get what I'm saying? And so that's a little bit.
I do, although side. Actually, let me push back on that just gently, in the sense that something that's quite different about space is often there aren't the same market forces, right? So anything that you can do to make money with a new technology will probably arise organically. Uh-huh. However, it does take large social investments often to get to the next step of space. So I think, you know, again, with low Earth orbit, I think we've crossed that threshold where market forces can do a lot. The government is still an important tenant, but it is not the only tenant, and there would be activity without it. You know, with deep space, I would say we're not yet there. I mean, you see sort of folks like Lockheed Martin setting up semi-commercial entities for cislunar space. But realistically, those are going to really be anchored by government customers in the short term. And then, you know, when we're looking at finding life on Europa or anything sort of beyond cislunar, it's still essentially completely the realm of governments to do. Now, I mean, I think we can cross that threshold, but there still needs to be, I mean, unless maybe you could imagine very wealthy individuals that just want to know, you know, is there life on a Jovian moon funding this? I think it does need to be a conscious societal choice just because of the scale of resources. And hopefully eventually we can then get to that point where it's self-catalyzing. So in general, I would agree with what you say that, you know, once technology develops, a thousand flowers bloom and people use it in all the different ways. But I'm not sure if that's always true in space. I mean, you know, I'm happy to have you disagree and say I'm
not. I appreciate. Thank you for the pushback. I always like a good debate, right? As iron sharpens iron, it just makes the narrative more crisp. So I would completely concede your claim that it is going to require government to be involved in the early stages, right? This is think the analog I typically think of. When I'm kind of rolling this stuff around the sandboxes, the forts in the wilderness, if you will, you know, it usually requires the government to establish those initial reasons for being in locations that are potentially hostile. But I think in my mind, when you have the capability, because I'm also, you know, wearing my government cap, right? Whenever I think about what missions are we going to plan as an agency? Right. And so when the teams get together, and I've been the prop guy on those teams that led to Waypoint Gateway and some stuff with that currently we're doing now, you know, we dig around in the bag of Lego bricks of capabilities, right? And we start looking at these Lego bricks and we glom them together. And then we look at this kind of, can this do this kind of a mission? Can it do that kind of a mission? And I think my corollary is, right, with that kind of a framework in mind in terms of how things get thought up, right, by the different people that might think about doing things for the reasons that they do. When those capabilities are already in the bag, right, and people are digging around for things to think about, those things are probably going to be exercised. But you're, I think you're absolutely right. There is a life cycle. This is going to spiral in terms of, you know, what that looks like. And yes, I think the first couple spirals will have heavy government involvement / subsidization, but it will be I still maintain the claim, it'll be a little less purely philosophical, and there'll be this practical aspect that's kind of baked into it. So in my mind, I don't think it may not be quite as hard of a sell as we might anticipate it might be. So I think that's the corollary I want to make.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So once we have terrestrial fusion, then it's much easier to do these other things and simply adapt it. It does change the dynamic of the conversation and make certain things much more likely to happen. So clearly, I think we could do a 2-hour podcast just on the philosophical things.
Yes. But
let's move the conversation at this point. And I would love to have another discussion with you, you know, in the future. But let's turn it to what is concretely LSI doing, and then we can sort of get more into the pathway.
Right. So Limitless Space Institute is a nonprofit. Our mission is to inspire and educate the next generation to travel beyond our solar system and to support the research and development of enabling technologies, right? And so this definitely fits in the spirit and intent and some of the reasons for this discussion with us today. You know, we are a doing organization, and we are definitely trying to put rubber to the road in the process of trying to take that mission statement and translate it into programs of activity, if you will. And so, you know, we're definitely very interested in connecting with youth, you know, K-12, and then connecting with students in university from undergraduate to graduate to postdoc. And so we have a couple of programs, one of which is like the Limitless Educator Program. So this is a program that's been stood up by an award-winning educator, Casey Hines. And so this program, we have selected 20 amazing educators from across the globe that fit into this K-12 regime, and they are working together as a group to develop lesson plans that kind of speak to some of the things that are necessary to enable the bold visions we were just ruminating about, right? And trying to get those lesson plans to, you know, be free for teachers all over the planet to be able to use to bring into their classrooms. And then try and get kiddos aware and excited about some of the possibilities for the future, right? So that's the K-12 zip code. When it comes to college, we have our LSI Grants and Fellowship Program. And so this is a program where we give out grants to universities to pursue research and development of, you know, bold ideas, whether it's solar sails, beamed energy propulsion, fusion propulsion, nuclear electric propulsion, even switching into the frontiers of physics, you know, the idea of a space warp or a wormhole. We've funded universities to do some of that very foundational physics work. And so we've partnered with well over 30 universities and institutes the globe over, and we have a lot more in work. We'll try and continue that program. We do research internally here at our lab, just on the other side of this camera. There's a few thousand square feet of lab space with some really nice equipment. We've been funded by DARPA Defense Science Office to do some foundational physics work. In this case, exploring the nature of the quantum vacuum, and can we potentially have, you know, some technological implications as a result of exploring this physics. And so we've been manufacturing some nanoscale test devices, in our case, something we would call custom Casimir cavities, and exploring, you know, what's the physics implications of that, and then what are the potential technological implications of that. And so that's kind of LSI in a nutshell in the, you know, little bit more than 90 seconds narrative. So
that's great. And how did LSI get started?
So LSI got started in the tail end of 2019. I was still at NASA at the time. Brian B.K. Kelly, a fellow NASA individual, he was the head of the flight operations director at NASA Johnson Space Center. He retired just a few months earlier. And for folks that may not know, the flight operations directorate is that's the organization that picks the astronauts and assigns the crews and plan, train, fly astronauts in space. And so BK had retired maybe June, July in 2019, and he reached out to me through my management at NASA JSC and wanted to talk about STEM. So I do a lot of STEM engagement, talking to schools and universities and organizations all over. So I thought this was just going to be a speaking engagement. And so when I chatted with him, he was like, yeah, no, I actually want you to maybe entertain the notion of leaving NASA and helping me stand up this.
He was
this
poaching non-profit. You. It was a scam to lure you in.
Yeah. So right. So he approached me, and I, after some thought and prayer and considering things, it seemed like a good opportunity to kind of increase the game on what's always been important to me, which is working towards trying to enable our ability to get human beings anywhere in the solar system, and maybe one day even on to another star system. And so we, I left NASA in December of 2019. We got our nonprofit acknowledgement from the IRS, I think in May of 2020, the one and only time in my life that I was excited to get a letter from the IRS. So we got our 501c3 categorization in May. And we have, we are a philanthropic organization for a lot of the stuff that we do. The Limitless Educators and the LSI Grants and Fellowships, those are philanthropic. The research, we win grants from the government and go do work for agencies and so forth. So that's a little bit more of the background of LSI's initiation. So
that's great. So let's talk a little bit about the technology pathways. And, you've already spoken about some of them. I also looked online at some materials you had from some DOE presentation, and you sort of had three categories: fission, fusion, and then what I might call novel. I don't remember exactly the term, but sort of
breakthrough.
Thank you. And so let's actually start with fission, because something I noticed that was of interest particularly to me was you focused on NEP.
Yes.
A nuclear electric propulsion, which is the opposite in a certain way, or opposite is a strong word, but quite different from what DARPA and NASA are at least emphasizing publicly with nuclear thermal propulsion. So why do you think NEP is the right focus area?
Right. So I'm gonna back up just a little bit and give a quick desert island physics example to kind of articulate the problem, right? Why we might chase one thing versus another, right? So, sending human beings to the outer solar system is very different from the things we think about when we talk about human space exploration today and what might even be in the next 5 or 10 years. Sending human beings back to the surface of the moon, we can do that with chemical propulsion, right? The performance of those rockets is very, very capable, and we can do some awesome things. And chemical propulsion has sent robotic probes to different locations in the solar system. But when you start thinking about moving very far out in the solar system, but doing it in a very short period of time, this is where we run into what's called the time distance problem. If we want to send human beings to Saturn, let's say, we want to go visit a couple of moons there. We want to get them there in 200 days. The amount of energy that's necessary to accomplish that mission is an order of magnitude more energy than it takes to get a payload from the surface of the Earth to low Earth orbit. Right. So that 9.2 kilometers a second for that LEO type of mission. Now you're in order of magnitude, maybe even a little bit more, right? 20-fold over what you might need for LEO if you're trying to get humans to Saturn in 200 days. So all that to say, do some calculations, chemical propulsion will never close that, right? It's just not even remotely possible to do something like that. And so the question is, well, what do we do, right? And so when you look at the parameters associated with the things that help you design a space vehicle, right, you need new forms of advanced power and propulsion, right? And the question could be nuclear thermal propulsion, right, versus nuclear electric propulsion. Let's just kind of talk about that. We call that one of the three swim lanes. And that one is the known physics, known engineering, right? nuclear electric propulsion. That's kind of the thing we lean towards. But what about nuclear thermal propulsion? So let's just contrast the two. So nuclear electric propulsion is power and propulsion architecture where you got a nuclear reactor. Like just like you might have a nuclear reactor on a submarine or an aircraft carrier. It's just a little bit more lightweight. But it's in the megawatt level or maybe even higher, right? But you connect it to some form of electric propulsion. Like think a Hall thruster or an ion engine that's ionizing a gas and accelerating it using electromagnetic and or electrostatic fields. And so because of those fields, it's now no longer limited by the specific heat of combustion, right, with chemical propulsion. Mm-hmm. And so the speed at which those little bits go out the back of the thruster can be much, much higher, you know, many, many tens of thousands of meters per second. So the specific impulse is in the many thousands of seconds, right? And so when you look at that mission, 200 days to Saturn, with a spacecraft mass that supports a human crew, that's a big delta V, and you want specific impulses that are many thousands of seconds, right? Mm-hmm. So NEP can get that together and you can make that work. You just need the appropriate power level so that you can get the acceleration level that can do whatever it is you need to do in the time frame you want. So now let's talk about nuclear thermal rockets, nuclear thermal propulsion. So slightly different way to utilize nuclear in a way to get really fast stuff going out the back of the rocket. And so nuclear thermal rockets are kind of this neat capability that kind of gets into the realm of, you know, higher thrust, impulsive kind of thrust. So it looks and feels a little bit more like a chemical propulsion system because it's got more oomph to it when you turn the system on. But the specific impulse kind of does have a limit, right? And so we anticipate that's, you know, in and around 900 seconds of specific impulse, or you know, maybe around 9,000 meters per second. That's the velocity of the hydrogen that's coming out the back of the rocket. So there's a couple things that come to my mind, right? When I think about nuclear thermal rockets, the temperature is probably 2,800 degrees Kelvin. And that is, you know, 400 degrees away from the boiling point of steel, I believe, right? So that's extremely hot. And so when we actually built nuclear thermal rockets in the 60s and tested them, in the desert, you know, they were able to achieve 863 seconds specific impulse, but they also eroded that core, the nuclear core, and put some of that nuclear core in the plume that kind of went out and spread out over the desert, right? And so the thought process today is that we have ceramic metals that could potentially overcome that challenge and they can survive that 2,800 degrees Kelvin. And so, okay, maybe so, right? And that's, I think, what they're working hard to go do. But it's still a challenge. That is hard. It is extremely hot. But all that to say, I don't think we're going to go, it's not like 900 seconds is like version one and version two can be 1,100 and version three can be 1,500, right? That's not the growth path. Nuclear thermal rockets, I think you're talking about the Z, that's like the Ferrari performance that you're going to get out of nuclear thermal rocket. So how well does 900 seconds do when you're looking at the delta V to get to Saturn in 200 days? Well, it's not much more useful than the chemical propulsion. So my consternation when I've looked at and compared and contrasted NTP versus or NTR versus NEP is extensibility, right? So I worked on the nuclear systems working group when I was at NASA as a group of a number of about five or six folks that were helping NASA prioritize how it spends money on nuclear. And so we talked about this a lot. And so there are people that maintain NTR is better for the following reasons that they give, right? And then there are those in the community that say NEP is the better approach for the following reasons that they give, right? And I personally think we don't have enough money to, you know, to do both in parallel. It's, we have to choose between one or the other. And so if I had to choose, right, I go with NEP because NEP is extensible. In my mind, NTP is not, right? But, you know, there are other reasons why people think NTP is better for whatever reasons they've given. And so NASA and DARPA have partnered on that. And so if they're successful and they develop that, as somebody that's been one of the mission planners, you put a new Lego brick in my bag that I dig around with, I'm glad to make use of it if they make use of it. But if I had to prioritize, right, I would probably prioritize NEP.
So. No, that makes a lot of sense. And the from the people I've talked to, my understanding of why at least NASA went with NTP is it makes a lot of sense if you're just going to Mars. Mm-hmm. It gets you sort of there's fewer breakthroughs that are required because of the research that was done under NERVA. Mm-hmm. And they care more about the delta V than the specific impulse. Mm-hmm. But as you say, if you are not just sending people to Mars, but trying to do things longer distances, then the calculation becomes different, but there's no congressional mandate yet for mm-hmm. those other missions. So mm-hmm. they're just thinking within the sort of mission to Mars parameters. So that's NEP, and you sort of talked about how that's within the realm of known physics, known engineering, although, I mean, there's work to do, but we kind of know what's happening. Right. So now let's move into that next realm of known physics, less well-established engineering.
Right. That's our second swim lane, right? And so why even talk about the second swim lane, right? So LSI is definitely focused on trying to enable interstellar, right? So mm-hmm. the delta Vs are enormous, right? And so when you look at nuclear electric propulsion as a capability, right, to its fullest extensibility, right, the specific impulses that we can achieve with some of the forms of electric propulsion that have been discussed in the literature, right, that kind of a system, an NEP vehicle, if you wanted to do an interstellar mission, an NEP vehicle would probably still take a couple of thousand years to get to, you know, Proxima Centauri, which is just, you know, stellar-wise really close, right, 4.25 light years. So NEP takes a long time. And so if you want to try and reduce that multi-thousand-year mission to something that's maybe a century or, you know, half a century, you kind of need to look to something new. And that's where fusion kind of brings some relief, right? Fusion propulsion allows us to get much higher exhaust velocities on the rocket. And so that then translates into higher achievable cruise speeds. So then you can maybe look at a interstellar mission that's 50 to 150 years in duration. So you were going to say something, so let me pause.
Yeah, I know. I was just thinking, you know, I can muster up empathy for my great grandchildren. Mm-hmm. It's sort of when we get beyond that, it gets a little more difficult. But so, mm-hmm. you know, 100 years I can conceive of, 1,000 years, it seems it would be hard to mobilize anything. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of quick questions. Do you think NEP is good enough to get a solar system wide civilization and economy going, or is that still too slow?
Yeah, I think NEP has the potential to give us the entire solar system. Yes, okay. Right. It's been discussed in literature and explored as a capability. Now, granted, we're going to have, you know, pretty big reactors that would be lots and lots and lots of megawatts, maybe even starting to get into gigawatts, where, you know, now we're talking reactors that are on the size of what we might think about for a nuclear aircraft carrier. But that's in a time frame where we've mastered a lot of capabilities and so forth. Right. In terms of getting stuff to space and doing things. But as a capability, once that Lego brick's in the bag, that Lego brick has a lot of extensibility, right? And so NEP, if we did nothing else, is like, you know, locomotives for the solar system, right? That gives us a solar system, the opportunity for a solar system community, right? But I do think fusion is something that will be on the horizon at some point. And I think there may be an early opportunity for fusion to be something that's involved in spaceflight, where it's not that, you know, that the TV show Expanse, right? That's a great fictional TV show that uses fusion as a propulsion capability. But I think there's an opportunity for us to have fusion. It's like an early version of fusion where, just like a Hall thruster is a form of electric propulsion that we plug into a power source, mm-hmm. whether that's solar panels or nuclear reactor, whatever, right? You still got to plug it in. It's a client. Fusion as a propulsion system where it's a client. So hold on. Let me explain what I'm talking about. We could potentially have a fusion propulsion system that has a physics coefficient of performance of say 5, right? So it gets, you know, 5 watts of thermal power out for every watt of electrical power that we put in. And so that 5 watts of thermal power out may not be enough to drive a thermodynamic cycle to provide electric power back to the thruster to self power itself and generate thrust. So we would still potentially need to plug it in if it only had a physics coefficient of performance of 5, like plug it into a nuclear reactor, let's say. But it has, because it has a physics coefficient of performance of 5, it's going to be extremely more efficient, a lot more newtons per kilowatt, if you will, because it's augmenting the, it's like a fusion afterburner, if you will. So it's putting a lot of power in just through the fusion process that's occurring. So the jet power, right, is a lot more capable. So fusion may find an early opportunity in space flight where we have much smaller fusion reactors that are, I mean, they're just propulsion systems, and they still have to plug in because they only have physics coefficient of performances of 5, right? And so maybe you got a 100 kilowatt fusion thruster that gives you a whole lot more newtons per kilowatt than you get out of an equivalent Hall thruster, right? Because it's augmenting itself.
So that's sort of, we haven't redesigned the whole system. We're just using a better battery in the form of fusion on the path to doing something really more radically different.
Yeah, so this could be an intermediary version of fusion before we get to the amazing things where the reactor generates all the power it needs to generate the thrust that it's providing, right? So in other words, there's no external power source. The fusion engine is both the power source and the propulsion source together, right? Direct fusion drive, right? This is a precursor where fusion is a client that still has to plug into solar panels or a nuclear reactor, whatever, right? But it's just, you get a lot more newtons per kilowatt than you might get out of a Hall thruster.
Is it worth working on fusion related projects for space at this point, or should we just be waiting for the terrestrial fusion ecosystem to shake out? And there's, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars going into that. And then just sort of when that's sorted, we can then start applying it to space. Do you think now is the right time to make certain investments, or is it just too early?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The great question, right? And in my mind, like a lot of things, I don't think we have to be sequential, right? And there actually are people today that are looking at making, you know, fusion propulsion in parallel with the folks that are making the efforts for the terrestrial fusion, right? Terrestrial fusion, you got a couple of major players out there, Commonwealth Fusion and MIT spinoff, right? That's kind of taking advantage of the development of RICO, high temperature superconducting tape, as a magnetic capability. You know, they've raised an enormous amount of money in the venture capital world. Their Series B, B as in Bravo, their Series B round was $1.8 billion. I mean, a Series B, $1.8 billion. That's just like, what? What is that even about? But I mean, they got a big facility that they've been building up in Massachusetts. And, you know, I think they're a really good contender to maybe come up with a terrestrial fusion demonstration reactor, maybe even in advance of what ITER could potentially do. But ITER's the, you know, the globe's effort was kind of started in the 90s. But you've also got some upstarts that are looking at the niche application of space and encouraged by all of this development in computational capability. Online computing.
Do you mind mentioning some names? I might actually reach out to them too.
Yeah, please. Helicity Space, right? Cepheon Yu at Helicity Space is working on a fusion propulsion system that definitely is what I just described to you. It is a propulsion capability that still has to be plugged in, right? But because of the fact that it integrates fusion into its operational physics principle, it's going to get a whole lot more newtons per kilowatt than you would get out of an equivalent Hall thruster, if you will. So he's got a team working on that. You've got Princeton Satellites, I believe, is also working on a fusion propulsion system. There are a couple of universities that are doing some early work to try and think about coming up with some fusion propulsion systems. And some are even, you know, they're not just the client, they're actually fusion propulsion systems. So they're direct fusion drives. Ray Sedgwick at University of Maryland. You've got Dr. Jason Cassibury, Professor Jason Cassibury at University of Alabama Huntsville. He's got a fusion concept, and Gabe Zhu, Professor Gabe Zhu at XU at University of Alabama Huntsville also is working on a fusion concept. And there may be some others as well, but those are some of the ones that I'm immediately familiar with that are thinking about things. So,
yeah. Okay, so, and that's in the realm of known physics, unknown engineer or engineering frontiers.
Yeah, engineering frontiers. Yeah, because we don't have that Iron Man, you know, reactor in the size of this coffee cup. We don't have that yet, right? So
hopefully the 2030s will be the goal
right.
And so let's talk about the last category. And I was interested to hear, it sounds like you are, I mean, that's sort of where your focus may be, in that breakthrough area. So tell us what you think sort of is interesting and possible there, and a little more about what you're doing in that space.
Right. So, you know, thinking about the three swim lanes and the segue of this discussion from one to the other, you know, 2000 years for nuclear electric propulsion, known physics, known engineering, maybe a century for known physics, but unknown engineering, right? But then moving into the unknown, we know from general relativity, for example, that the idea of a space warp or a wormhole, those concepts are mathematically possible. Right. And we see evidence of, you know, inflation where space can expand and contract at any speed. Right. So, you know, maybe nature can do it. Is there any way we could do something like that in a practical sense that could be used to decrease that transit time from 100 years to maybe 20 years, or maybe even something that we see in the TV shows, like, you know, 6 months or something like that, or, you know, 200 days. And that's where we definitely need to kind of think about moving to the frontiers of physics, because although we anticipate that the idea of a space warp or a wormhole has a mathematical basis, we can't tell people what to go build to go make something like that physically manifest. We kind of have to look to the frontiers of physics. And so I'll back it up and frame it in a slightly different way. If you think about everything that we know of physics today as a Venn diagram, it's a fairly simple Venn diagram. There's just two circles on the Venn diagram, and they touch at a tangent point. So it's like a little horizontal figure eight, if you will, right? And so in one circle is the words quantum mechanics. And so that, or quantum field theory, to be precise, that represents our best understanding of the microscopic world. How do atoms and electrons and light behave, right? And of course, we have cell phones and digital technology and everything as a result of that body of knowledge. The other circle, you have the words general relativity, and that helps us understand how do the stars behave, how do galaxies evolve, how has the universe continued to progress, and dark energy and dark matter and different things come out of that and black holes. And so now, from that's an amazing thing, but from a practical perspective, right? We at the beginning of this segment, we talked about global positioning satellites, right? So GPS. The atomic clocks that are on board the GPS satellites have to make software corrections for special relativistic issues and general relativistic issues. So those atomic clocks are so precise that you have to correct for that. So when you use your phone to GPS navigate to a restaurant to go meet a friend you haven't seen for a while, that GPS system has to make those accommodations for general relativity. So just that knowledge of physics affects us every single day, if you think about that. Now, we know that those two circles, right, they only touch at a tangent point. The quantum mechanics through the Dirac equation has been made compatible with special relativity. But it is not, we have no quantized theory of gravity. So quantum mechanics and general relativity are not currently compatible. There's a lot of ideas that people are rolling around in the sandbox, but we don't know yet. So all that to say, there's this much broader understanding that we have yet to decode, right, that encircles both of those small circles on the Venn diagram, right? And so as we come up with new mathematical frameworks that help us maybe put additional circles on that Venn diagram that intersect those two circles to different degrees, right? We're going to come up with new mathematics and new insights that's going to motivate us to go through and explore first the science, but then may also have some technological implications. I mean, consider E equals MC squared, right? Beautiful coffee cup worthy expression, maybe even on the t-shirt, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
Arrived in 1905. We split the first atom, I think in 1932, 35, something like that. We had the first nuclear reactor generating 0.5 watt underneath the squash court in Chicago. I have no idea how they got there.
That's a weird place to put it, but
right. But you know, in 1945, we had the Trinity test, and that is a disruptive paradigm shift in the existence of humanity, right? Where you're now seeing the significant relationship of E equals MC squared. You know, if you have this much mass, it can do, you know, this much, right? And that's a paradigm shift in our understanding of the world. That's 40 years from the coffee cup to the paradigm shift. So that's without machine learning, without artificial intelligence, without computers, without parallel computing, right? So imagine in the process of us exploring what's beyond quantum mechanics, what's beyond general relativity, what are some of the ideas, as people find mathematics coupled with some empirical data, right? As they find things that kind of map out in between those two circles, there's going to be all kinds of things that we really just can't imagine today, because we don't have the physics intuition that guide us, right? And so we think that there may be a lot of fruit in the process of exploring that, right? So let me spend another 90 seconds drawing a corollary for, you know, the importance of understanding the two zip codes, if you will, and we might want to fill in the gap. So let's talk about the idea of both a space warp and a wormhole. In the context of general relativity, the idea of a space warp and a wormhole needs something that's called exotic matter in the context of general relativity. So exotic matter is negative mass. And I mean, that's literally mass, but it's just negative, right? And so what does that even mean, right? We have no idea in the context of general relativity how to manifest negative mass. And so anytime somebody identifies a model in literature that requires something that falls in that category, violates energy conditions, this, you know, and then we highlight that in the paper, and you know, maybe this means this is not physical. So let's think about that other circle, quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. Quantum mechanics has some interesting characteristics that might be relevant to this discussion. Are you familiar with the Casimir phenomena?
I'm not.
Okay, so I'll this is going to be 180 seconds, not 90 seconds, right? So, so in quantum mechanics, the idea of empty space is different from what we think of empty space as, you know, classical existence, right? You know, we have a vacuum chamber, we turn on vacuum pumps, we pull all the air out, and we anticipate if it's a classical vacuum, there's nothing in there, right? Now, quantum mechanics, because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, says that empty space isn't empty. There are virtual particles that pop into and out of existence all the time. This virtual field of fermion, anti-fermion pairs, right? And so a observational consequence of this maelstrom of activity that's predicted mathematically is something called the Casimir force or Casimir phenomena. And so you can manifest that in the following way. Imagine that my hands are two metallic plates. When we put them in close proximity to one another, like we're about to clap, right? Mm-hmm. Now imagine the size of these plates are, you know, micrometers in cross-sectional area, you know, 40 microns by 40 microns, and the separation distance is in maybe hundreds of nanometers. So this is the mental scale I want you to think of. And so we can take those two metallic plates and we can put them in that, in a vacuum chamber that we were just kind of talking about. And we're going to imagine for a moment, Timothy, that you have superpowers. And we're going to ask you to go into that vacuum chamber, and we want you to measure the pressure on the outside of the plates and the pressure between the two plates. Mm-hmm. And our expectation is you're going to report back to us, your little micro Ant-Man self. You're going to say zero, zero on the outside. And we're going to fully anticipate you're going to say zero in between the two plates. But what you report back is there is a negative pressure between the two plates. And you're going to be like, wait, hold on, what's going on, right? So this is the quantum vacuum. This is a characteristic of quantum vacuum. Those two plates in close proximity restrict which wave modes can appear between them. So when you integrate over the full spectrum of vacuum fluctuations, there's now a deficiency between those two plates. So the vacuum state between the two is at a lower energy level. It is a negative vacuum energy density, right? So this was derived in 1948. It was measured to the community's satisfaction in 1996, and it's been explored hundreds of times by, you know, folks at universities all over the globe. Maybe a terrestrial analog to help with this is to maybe envision a Pacific atoll island, right? It's like a little horseshoe or almost a full ring. Maybe it's got a nice little lagoon, right, in the center of the Pacific atoll, right? And so outside of the atoll, you've got all the wave energy of the Pacific, right, let's say. And it's all this energy that's going on, the boats are rocking and so forth. But if they want to go to a more quiescent point, they go inside the atoll, right? And the atoll, the size of that atoll now prevents a lot of wave modes that are too big getting into that center lagoon. And so the lagoon is much more quiescent, if you will. That's just a loose hydrodynamic analog for the idea I'm trying to communicate to you. So,
and so does this create the equivalent of negative mass or energy that you can then manipulate in the ways?
Right. Yeah. So the mathematical characteristics of what's going on in between the two plates, that negative vacuum energy density, looks and feels just like the stuff we call exotic matter in general relativity, right? And so Alcubierre, Miguel Alcubierre, in his paper on this topic of the idea of a space warp, highlighted that in his paper and said, hey, we violate these energy conditions. We need to note this, but we can satisfy these requirements by looking to quantum mechanics and the concept known as the Casimir phenomena as a way to substitute for what general relativity calls exotic matter. We can bring negative vacuum energy density to the table. So therein lies a great motivation for, we got two circles. So we got something here, kind of looks like it could solve this problem here, but we need to fill in the gaps between the two to understand, you know, what does that really need to look like to make that idea work?
Got it. And so, you know, you said for NEP, thousands of years to do an interstellar mission. For fusion, we're getting to 50 to 150. And now this frontier physics, we don't even really know what we're getting into with this. So yeah.
20 years and less, right? So maybe you're getting to a point where you're starting to look like some of the romantic visions we've seen in science fiction, right? Where, you know, it's a fraction of a human lifetime. It's probably just the simplest way to point it, in a fraction of a human lifetime.
Yeah. Great. Well, again, I think we've got a whole other 2-hour podcast that we could break out on this, but I'm going to sort of transition a little to, you know, what do you see as the scale of capital needed to sort of move in these directions?
Right, right. Yeah, and I apologize if you can hear like a weed eater over my shoulder. There's somebody doing some groundwork.
Very vaguely, but actually not much.
Okay, right. So in terms of research, a lot of the stuff that you know, we're connected with is you know, it's basically 6.1 basic research to 6.2 applied research. Right, so it's all very early stage stuff, and so even the grants that we give out are akin to NIAC or an SBIR. So $100,000, $200,000. So it's that order of investment, right? It's very early stuff. In a lot of cases, we kind of feel that some of the early ideas are well suited when we partner with academia, right? Because when you're partnering with academia, routinely you get, you know, very rigorous scientists that have access to a lot of computational capabilities, students to help out, and oftentimes laboratory capabilities as well. So I think from our perspective, that's certainly the mode of operation we would continue on. In terms of like opportunities for even bigger, right? Maybe at a certain point, if maybe like the idea of a fusion propulsion system, if maybe they hit like a certain level of performance, like let's say Felicity Space or Princeton Satellite. So I think those are two commercial companies, right? If they were to get to some level of maturity, right, maybe some municipal organization might say, I want to explore that really quickly, right? Maybe that could open that up to something where there's two commas involved in the funding level, and maybe that could speed things up, if you will. When it comes to like that third most swim lane, right, I think it just depends, right? Because you never I mean, you can't give an exact time frame for a breakthrough, if you will.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's important to always be planting seed corn so that there's a potential for a crop. Right. But when something crops up to a certain point, it may actually develop really quickly. Right. So that's the thing that's interesting about, that's why I gave the equals MC squared example. Right.
Yeah.
If somebody comes up with a good solid data set that says, hey, this new physics idea is valid and it predicts all these new things, you know, things might exponential growth, maybe much quicker than we would anticipate. And who knows? Right. So.
And what do you think the role of philanthropic capital might be in this space? I think, you know, there's a lot of government capital going in, and that's some of what you're doing, you know, and then there's VC capital for where they think they can finally close a business case, at least, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years. But, you know, what do you think large foundations might be able to do, or medium-sized foundations?
Right. So, In the big picture, right, the whole premise of philanthropic, there's a give get type of thing, right? You know, people give to something philanthropically because their heart is connected to it,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, you know, Perimeter Institute is an interesting example of an institute that's dedicated to theoretical physics, right? Perimeter Institute dedicated to theoretical physics. They've been around, I think, maybe about 20 years almost. They were founded by, I believe, the guy that founded BlackBerry and a couple of his colleagues that founded BlackBerry. And so they endowed that institute with, I think, probably $140 million. And so this is up in Canada. And they were augmented by the kind of the equivalent state and federal government, if you will. The organizations up there helped provide some land for a building, provided some resources for a building. They provided operational budget. And so Perimeter Institute is a philanthropic institute that is exclusively dedicated to physics frontiers, if you will, theoretical mm-hmm. physics. So that whole thing I was talking about, what's beyond general relativity and quantum mechanics, that's all they do. That's all they want to
yeah.
do. And so they were endowed by some folks that were very successful in the commercial sector, doing things that were very useful. And their heart was connected with this idea, right, of theoretical physics, and they wanted to do something that helped enable that, right? And so when it comes to philanthropic, the critical thing is there has to be some kind of give-get connection with somebody who want to lean in for something. And so,
right.
The whole idea of enabling, you know, bold human exploration of the solar system and maybe one day the stars, that requires individuals to be connected to that goal and want to give into it. And so,
yeah.
you know, are there a series of, you know, wealthy folks that have made their money in more terrestrial things that at some point they want a legacy that's connected to this, right? And that could be whatever level it could be, right? But it could always be put to good use. Right.
Right.
And so, you know, we have some philanthropic donors that lean in with us in addition to our broader family of donors. And so I think there's always things that can be done that are very effective where we make the most out of every precious piece of a resource that we get from our partners, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. And let's close out with talking a little bit more about you and your journey. So how did you initially get interested in space?
Right. I think I've always been interested in science and engineering, right? Mm-hmm. At an early age, I was always interested in taking things apart and figuring out how they work. And, you know, I was a military brat, so I lived all over the U.S., but I spent a large percentage of my time as a youth in and around Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a chance to walk through the National Air and Space Smithsonian many a time as a young kid. And I was so fascinated and enthralled by not just the things that are, because there's a lot of neat things in the National Air and Space Smithsonian, but it's the stories behind the things that were, to me, were so very interesting about the people, right, that worked together to kind of push the boundaries of what we know, right, to accomplish and enable us to do things that we couldn't imagine that we could do at the time. And so that really resonated with me as a kid. And so I really kind of fell in love with aviation, and then a little bit later, the whole premise of space exploration. And so I think coupled with that, like a lot of people, you know, Star Trek played a role in my, that was something very neat to me in terms of the hope and the promise that that potentially showed for the human species and the human existence. And to a smaller degree, Star Wars, that's a little bit more to me like a fantasy. But yeah, I think all those things kind of worked together to help me realize that that stuff had currency with my soul. And so that motivated me to go get my degree in engineering. I got a bachelor's and master's in mechanical engineering, but I always knew I wanted to do advanced power and propulsion because I recognized very early there was this issue with the power and propulsion. And so I switched to physics. I got my PhD in physics from Rice University. And so that's where, you know, most of my passion now is exploring physics at the fundamental level. So most everything I do is that 6.1 basic research, kind of always keeping an eye for opportunities to adapt physics insights into some kind of an application.
Wonderful. Well, that I think that's the perfect note to close on. So Dr. White, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it was great. Thanks for your time today, Timothy. I appreciate everything you do. And, you know, please continue to try and communicate and advocate and talk to folks. It's good stuff, bud.
Thank you to Dr. White for joining the Multiplanetary Society podcast. And thank you to all our listeners. If you like this content, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform to ensure that you don't miss an episode, and leave a review to help other people find it. If you have any feedback or guest suggestions, please feel free to email us at multiplanetarysociety, all one word with no dashes, @gmail.com.